you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
From the Home Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. May Martinez. Impeachment, inauguration, recall, and re-election. It has been as busy as it gets in politics from D.C. to Sacramento. We'll review this past week and preview the next on State of Affairs. Plus, how today's athletes and pop stars doubling as social justice activists can trace their origins to one night in Miami. It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. Amy Martinez, thanks for being with us. Got a great show today. Going to dive right in and kick it off with State of Affairs, our weekly look at politics in the Golden State. President Trump has been impeached twice, and next week, President-elect Joe Biden is set to take over the White House. But unfortunately, nerves are frayed since demonstrators say they're set to take over D.C. and state capitals around the country as well. Joining us to discuss all of it, we have with us Marisa Lagos, correspondent for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk and co-host of the weekly show and podcast Political Breakdown. Also with us, Justin Levitt, professor of law at Loyola Law School, where he's an expert in constitutional law and the law of democracy. First, let's start with you, Justin. Set the stage for where Congress and the impeachment proceedings stand heading into next week's inauguration.
Well, as you said, Congress has, the House of Representatives has impeached President Trump for a second time. That then sends the process over to the Senate, although the precise timing of that is still up in the air. The Senate has declared itself out of session at least until next Tuesday. And the House has some discretion about exactly when to send the now successful impeachment charges over to the Senate for trial.
Now, once President Trump's term ends, Justin, how much do you foresee maybe congressional Democrats pulling whatever legal levers they can to maybe go after him? I mean, and what might those avenues be?
I think the primary lever is conviction, quote unquote, resolution of the trial in the Senate. Which would not only serve as a profound political statement against what the president had done, but also potentially bar him from rerunning for office, rerunning for president in 2024. Once a president, even a former president, has been tried, if the conviction is successful, and that's not conviction in the criminal sense, that's successfully prosecuting an impeachment, then Congress can vote to remove the opportunity for that individual to hold office under the United States executive office again.
Marisa Lagos, after last week's insurrection at the Capitol, at the U.S. Capitol, can you give us an overview of some of the security measures being installed in D.C.? Because I've seen some on TV and it looks pretty intense.
Yeah, I mean, they've brought thousands of National Guard troops in. They've completely sealed off the mall. You know, the public can't get there. The Capitol was already pretty locked down for people going through the normal processes because of COVID-19, right? The only visitors were allowed were members of Congress and their staff and, of course, in visitors that they brought in, which is why we're having some investigations now. But it does seem like there is just the full flanks of, you know, both federal and local law enforcement there preparing to really just not let people anywhere near the Capitol, which is the big question we all had last week, was like, why could people even get that close, right? If you know that a protest this big is happening and that there's been calls to march on the Capitol.
What about Sacramento, the capital here in California? Any security measures being taken up there?
Oh, yeah. It's the same. They've put up a pretty high fence around the entire Capitol Park, so you can't even get on the grass around the state capitol if you're familiar with that. They denied a permit to an organizer who was wanted to create a rally up there, a pro-Trump rally, saying that the numbers she had proposed were just too big under COVID. And they also have, you know, Capitol Police, Sergeant-at-Arms, CHP, everybody working together. I talked to some state lawmakers this week, and they said they feel pretty confident that the Capitol itself is secure. But there is concern that, you know, city halls, courthouses, local buildings that may not have that same level of protection could be at risk as well. And we just don't really know kind of where everything is going to play out, given how quickly things have progressed over the past week with security and really locking down. So maybe, you know, plans have changed.
And we've been hearing, as you mentioned, Marisa, about Congress people giving tours before the insurrection happened. And, I mean, there's a scary thought that that could be some intel, that they were getting intel on the actual building. Justin, what kind of legal consequences could there be for any Congress member who is found to have any level of involvement with the insurrection?
Well, members of Congress aren't immune from the statutes of the United States. They are protected for things that they say on the floor. The speech and debate clause of the Constitution protects them from the speeches they're giving, but it certainly doesn't protect them from aiding and abetting the breaking of a law. And here there are a number of federal provisions that those who rioted, those who breached the Capitol, those who intended to stop the operations of government through physical force and violence are potentially guilty of. And some of those include conspiracies that might reach to members of Congress who, knowing what they were going to do, intentionally aided and abetted them. I don't know that we know that there's information that would make out those claims just yet, but if we find it, it's certainly possible that members of Congress could be held to account.
And Justin, that's one I'm really hoping we don't find any. But I mean, if it happened, okay,
we are
yes.
All
we, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where we're crossing our fingers that that it didn't go that deep, because that would be horrifying. Meanwhile, of the 10 Republicans who voted for Trump's impeachment, California's David Valadao of Hanford, Central California, was one of them. Marisa, what do you make of him crossing the aisle, so to speak, on this one?
I mean, of the 10 GOP members of, you know, California's caucus in Congress, I think he is the most likely, was the most likely to do something like this. That district, as you may know, is really majority Democrat, or at least there's more Democrats registered, excuse me, than there are Republicans. It's a very purple place. You know, Valadao had lost to TJ Cox in 2018, reclaimed his seat this year. I think that he is taking the pulse of his district, and I think that he was never felt as sort of beholden to the far right, you know, wing of the party, as some other members did. But it is pretty remarkable that of 10 members, not a single other one stood up and spoke in favor of impeachment after everything we just detailed in terms of how horrific it was and just how many questions are outstanding about not just the president, but potentially other members of Congress's participation.
And I hate to be cynical about this, Marisa, but you mentioned taking the pulse of a district. How much of somebody's decision you think went into this thinking, okay, I need to know what my district's thinking, or make it just a simple moral question for each congressperson?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't been able to get a hold of Congressman Valadao, so I don't know. I mean, I do think, you know, I talked to former Senator Barbara Boxer yesterday, and she mentioned that she really does think that it takes, you know, some guts to do this as a Republican. They're not just because you're breaking with the party and the base might want to politically punish you, but because people have been getting physically threatened, right? I mean, look at the stories we're seeing right now about Mike Pence and the danger he was in that day. So I don't want to underplay what it takes to kind of stand up and do what you think is right. And I don't know if I'm sure David Valadao, like many members of Congress, is kind of thinking about both things. Yeah. But I you bring up an interesting point. I've been sort of toying over, like, what if we had a system where people just voted their hearts instead of what they thought, instead of the politics? But that's not the world we live in.
That's utopia, I think, right? Is that what that's called, that place?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Well, it's a fictional place, I think.
Yeah, that never will happen. Your thoughts, though, Marisa, on the state of partisanship in Congress, just among California lawmakers. Many of those newly minted representatives in Southern California, such as Michelle Steele, she voted against impeachment.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, Kevin McCarthy, we did see the House Minority Leader from Bakersfield, whose district, it's worth mentioning, borders Valadao's, did stand up and make probably the harshest comments we've heard against the president. He's been a very loyal ally, but he still voted against impeachment. I think that, you know, we are seeing signs that Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority, or Senate Majority Leader, might be leaning towards voting for impeachment if it actually gets to that point. We'll see. I think the caucus is really split right now. I think you have really far right members, especially from other states, who are angry about what they're seeing about the attacks on the president. And I think that, you know, for folks like Michelle Steele and Young Kim, this is going to be a tough road to walk, because in Orange County, you're already seeing some Republican registration numbers drop, a lot of anger from some constituents. And, you know, they just got elected in very tight races. So these are not like safe red districts. And I'm not sure how they're going to manage all of this moving forward. especially if Trump doesn't go quietly and or if there is indeed a trial in the Senate.
Well, speaking of Republican reps in other states, a Republican representative, brand new one from Georgia, says that she will file articles of impeachment against Joe Biden the day after he takes office. The article, she says, will be for abuse of power. That's Marjorie Taylor Greene. Justin, could this be the strategy of Republicans for the next 4 years, kind of a tit for tat kind of thing?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure it's tit for tat. We've had an armed attack on the Capitol, and there's no tat for that. That is a unique occurrence. The last time it happened, the only other time it happened, was an armed foreign army coming in and occupying the Capitol in the War of 1812. And this is the only other time. So I don't know what you'd think of as a response, a quote-unquote proportionate response. With respect to the Representative Green's threat to file articles of impeachment, that's theater. It's designed as theater. I don't know how many people will recognize or notice. It's silly to say that President-elect Biden will have abused his power just a few hours after taking the oath. It's implausible to find any evidence of that because he hasn't been president. But I do want to say that there will be some in the Republican Party who feel like catering to the conspiracy theory mob is a political necessity. On the other side of things, just responding to your last question, I don't know that it's only about standing up and doing what's right. A lot of the members that we just talked about who are facing real pressures in their home districts also have their own, not only physical safety, but political safety to think about. Remember, they were in the Capitol when it was attacked too, and failing to stand up and repudiate the fringe conspiracy means that the president essentially has faced no consequences, no meaningful consequences for what he's advocated. That's going to come back to bite an awful lot of members of Congress in the future, and potentially with threats to their physical safety. So I don't think it's just about standing up and getting a moral sense, potentially at odds to what's in your district. I think that most of these representatives and most of the senators are going to have to weigh real calculations about what's in their physical and political self-interest going forward.
Isn't that amazing, Justin? I mean, political survival, we've talked about that for years and years and years, but now it's mixed in and intertwined with physical survival.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's a measure in part of the fact that it's really hard to light a powder keg and then put out the flames mid-burn. What we've seen here is dangerous in fostering an alternative reality. I mean, the Trump administration began with alternative facts and it has ended with alternative facts. And in between, there's a lot of unmooring of a substantial set of the population from real facts. That's dangerous. It's fine to have different opinions. We all have different opinions. But to have different facts really means that this is going to be a very difficult country to govern. And as we saw last week, has some very real consequences in the real world.
Talking to Justin Levitt of Loyola Law School and Marisa Lagos, correspondent for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. Now, while Joe Biden gets to go back to the White House, Marisa Lagos, we've learned this week that longtime California U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein filed paperwork to run again in 2024. And there have been calls for her to resign. Her age is cited as one reason. Her more moderate liberal sensibilities are mentioned by progressives as another. What should we take away from her move to at least keep the door open for 2024?
Yeah, I don't make a ton of that. I mean, it could indicate, you know, that has no intention of stepping down before then, which I think is the bigger question. You know, she'll be, I believe, 90 by then. It's as you said, there's already kind of questions about whether she is slowing down and kind of mentally capable of doing this job. She has very strongly rejected those contentions. I know that some reporters who reached out to her campaign, they said, you know, were basically told this was pro forma. It was about changing an address on the FEC form. So I don't make predictions anymore after 2016, but I will predict right now that I am wrong. If she runs again in 24, like, the world is even crazier than I thought.
Well, the thing is, I just hope it's not because she's a woman, because there are other senators that are in her age range, and I haven't heard anything about their capabilities.
Yeah, and I think that's why this is such a sensitive topic. But look, I mean, the question... I think the question isn't whether, you know, in the past we have had certainly many male senators who I think folks feel outlasted their time at the Capitol. I think it's hard to talk about this because of both her gender and her age and because these are all sensitive. Some of the issues that have been brought up off the record by staff to reporters and others seem to indicate something bigger, that you know, she's not necessarily able to remember some information. One New Yorker story detailed that she would yell at staff after having that she didn't get a briefing a few hours after that briefing occurred. I think from Dianne Feinstein's perspective, though, she probably does not want to be pushed out on anyone's terms other than her own. And that may have a lot to do with the fact that she is still there. And we should mention she did step down from her leadership post on Judiciary, which is important now because Democrats do have control of the Senate. And I think that would have been a real headache for her if she had tried to keep on that position.
Justin, in terms of experience in the Senate, any advantage to being a senior member when it comes to committee assignments? Because if Feinstein leaves for whatever reason, then both of California senators would be very junior compared to their colleagues.
True. Although, as mentioned, the fact that she has stepped down from her chairmanship position in the Judiciary Committee is pretty important. So, there are advantages for sure. Not only do you know how the building works, and I don't just mean, you know, how to use the phones and where to walk. It takes a while to get used to the rhythm of working with other senators. And there's no question that those who've been there for longer have a lot more experience about ways to make common bond, both with other members of the party and with those across the aisle. But also, traditionally, important committee leadership positions are based on seniority. And normally, you'd see the senior members of a delegation, the senior members of the Senate, sitting on committee chairs. We've already seen Senator Feinstein step back from her Judiciary Committee role. And that may be a little bit more of an indication that although she is still an unquestionably important member of the Senate, there may be less sort of at risk in giving up chairships in her position than there might have been in others.
All right, one more for the road here. California Democrats are now speaking up against the recall effort of Gavin Newsom. Marisa, we've talked about how seriously Gavin Newsom may or may not be taking it, but now California Democratic Chair Randy Hicks called it the California coup, a right-wing coup. Do you read this as a sign as California Democrats are actually taking this seriously now?
Yes, I think they are. I think they're worried. I think they're also trying to capitalize on this political moment. I mean, we just detailed the anger we're seeing even from some Republicans at everything that unfolded over the past week. I think that they realize that some of the people backing this recall, funding it, or just supporting it are the same people who are in Washington voting against impeachment or voting to overturn some of the election results. And so I think that it's kind of a combination. You know, it's an interesting question if they should be using that language in this moment. But right, certainly, right. You know, I think they are really trying to yoke this effort to the anger that many people do feel at the president and the party that he is part of. And so I think it's a little bit of both.
500 more signatures to go with about 9 weeks. Justin, how serious do you gauge this?
I think it will get some momentum. It will certainly get some press coverage. I think given how polarized California is, it is exceedingly unlikely that a measure backed by Republicans at this moment will have much impact in recalling a popular Democratic governor, even if people are frustrated with some of the efforts of some of the measures of coronavirus response.
That's Justin Levitt, professor of law at Loyola Law School, and Marisa Lagos, correspondent for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk, co-host of the show Political Breakdown. Justin, Marisa, have a safe weekend.
You too, eh?
Thanks very much. You too.
More Take Two coming up in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Mi vida, yo te adoro. No sé por qué, pero de ti me enamoré. No sé por qué te amo tanto. No sé por qué, por qué.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm Amy Martinez. Starting today, Dodger Stadium is open for mass vaccinations. It's one of the six large vaccination sites opening around LA County. The other five open next Tuesday. It's all part of an effort to get hundreds of thousands of health workers immunized by the end of the month. KPCC's Jackie Fortier reports.
The first thing you notice in the Dodger Stadium parking lot isn't the view of downtown Los Angeles or the swaying palm trees. It's the bright orange traffic cones, more than 20,000 of them dotting acres of black pavement to keep cars twisting and turning through long lines on their way to the COVID-19 vaccine. L.A. Deputy Mayor Jeff Gorel says for once, the traffic is intentional.
Bumper-to-bumper traffic lined up and slowly snaking their way through the sea of cones.
It's a technique they perfected when Dodger Stadium was a testing site.
We were testing over 10,000 people a day here. But really the future is with the vaccinations.
This week, workers were assembling carts that will help health workers move among the cars with multiple doses of vaccine. Switching Dodger Stadium from testing to vaccinating is part of an effort to speed up California's painfully slow vaccine rollout. The state received the most doses of any in the country, but has only administered about a quarter of its supply. Gorel hopes Dodger Stadium will help change that. Staff will vaccinate 12,000 people a day.
We've begun to develop some plans to possibly go to 24 hours a day if we have both the team members to staff it as well as the vaccinations coming in to support a 24-hour operation.
That may sound like a lot, but Karen Michaels, an epidemiologist at UCLA, says it's just not fast enough.
We'll have to try to do better.
She says mass vaccination sites like Dodger Stadium are a good start, but LA County has 10 million people, roughly the same population as the entire state of Georgia. Officials, she says, need to think bigger.
We need Dodger Stadium, and we need probably 10 times or maybe 20 times Dodger Stadium. Convention centers need to be transformed into vaccine sites. We need to be much more ambitious.
Right now, there are 75 vaccination sites in L.A., but even with those in place, L.A. health officials estimate it will be summer before they start vaccinating healthy adults. Michaels says faster vaccinations are urgent because of the new, more contagious variant.
We are running out of time. We need to get as many people vaccinated as we can because this new mutant is so infectious that it could really make the situation that is already very bad even worse.
She's talking about the current COVID surge that's hammering LA hospitals. Intensive care unit beds have been full for weeks. Administrators are teetering on implementing battlefield triage medicine, where care is given to people more likely to survive. And on top of that, about 15,000 Angelenos are testing positive every day for the virus. Michaels says the only way to stop it is to vaccinate.
The vaccine is not going to do anybody any good if it's sitting in the freezer. So it needs to get into the people.
Local health officials are under pressure to open up vaccines to people 65 and over, which was okayed this week by Governor Gavin Newsom. But LA County's size means they still aren't through health workers, says County Public Health Director Barbara Ferrer.
Our estimate is that there are between 700 and 800,000 healthcare workers that qualify to be vaccinated in phase 1A. It's a big number.
So for now, only health workers will be inoculated at Dodger Stadium. It joins other super vaccination sites like Disneyland in Orange County, where Californians used to go for entertainment. Now they go for treatment. Covering health, I'm Jackie Fortier.
And now Jackie's with us to answer a few more questions about the county's vaccine rollout. Jackie, Dodger Stadium opened this morning. It's a big place. How many health workers do they plan to vaccinate?
Yeah, they're ramping up today and starting with just about 2,000. And Deputy Mayor Jeff Gorel told me they plan on vaccinating up to 12,000 people per day starting next week.
Okay, nice. How exactly will that process work?
Right now, people will get the Moderna vaccine at Dodger Stadium, and then all the vaccinations, of course, are free. They'll be screened, and identification will be checked to make sure that they have an appointment and that they're a health worker when they drive up in their cars. And then people will be directed to one of three areas within the parking lot. I was there yesterday, and there is just this sea of cones, and then these three areas where people will be. Cars will pull up in groups of 10, and health workers will use these carts to move between the vehicles, and they'll conduct some pre-screening interviews, and then they'll administer the vaccine right through the car window. And then people will just have to hang out in their cars for about 15 minutes, just in case they have a reaction to the vaccine. It's very rare, but it is a possibility.
And they'll also get a card, which will, it's a physical card, which will give them the date that they were vaccinated, the brand name of the vaccine, which is important. If you get the Moderna vaccine, you need to get the second dose of the Moderna vaccine. And then they'll need to make a follow-up appointment to get that second dose a few weeks later. But it doesn't, of course, have to be at the same site. It does need to be the same brand, though.
All right. Now, just to be 100% clear, only healthcare workers will be given the vaccine right now, and they have to make an appointment.
Yes, that's correct. And if you're a healthcare worker who qualifies, you can make an appointment at the LA County website.
And those managing the Dodger Stadium site to prepare for a lot of people showing up, even if they don't have appointments, I'm thinking there might just be a risk of it being overrun with people just desperate for a vaccine.
Yeah, that is possible. It's happened in a couple places, not in LA County. When I asked Deputy Mayor Jeff Gorrell that yesterday, he told me, quote, "We are ready for any possibility." They do have workers at the very beginning. Like, you, if you didn't have an appointment and you got there, you're not going to get anywhere close to getting the vaccine.
Okay,
they have people checking, and then they'll just turn you around. It'd be like if you tried to get into Dodgers without a ticket. It's not going to happen.
I used to do that when I was younger, Jackie, a long time ago, but hopefully they've tightened that up. Now, for those people who might have mobility issues, how's the county going to make sure people who lack cars, for example, get to Dodger Stadium to get vaccinated, or another spot maybe?
Yeah, so that's the thing to remember. Dodger Stadium is the largest, but it's not the only one. There are 75 vaccination sites that are open right now as we speak across LA County. Some health workers, of course, got immunized at work, say if they were at work at a hospital. But this larger tier of health workers that now qualify, there's a lot of people who travel around who now qualify for the vaccine. So in-home carers, for example, for elderly folks, and like lab technicians. So that's why we need these big, big sites. County health officials estimate that we still have about 500,000 health workers. So the county is also opening up 5 other large vaccination sites next week, including Pomona Fairplex, the Forum, Cal State Northridge, an LA County Office of Education, and Magic Mountain. And I do feel like I need to just reiterate this. The vaccine is free.
I've seen signs. Yeah, no, I mean, it's, we need to like just reiterate it, because I've seen signs saying COVID only $100. I mean, people need to know that it's absolutely free. And really quick, you dipped out for a second. 500,000 healthcare workers left to vaccinate in LA County?
Yeah, there's about 500,000 left to vaccinate in LA County. So that's why we need to have these big, big vaccination sites in order to take care of all of them. And then, of course, it also helps the county health officials ramp up for the larger groups of people that we're going to start vaccinating. Health officials estimate that in LA County, they'll start on people 65 and over at the beginning of February. That, of course, is if we have enough of the vaccine.
All right, that's KPCC's Jackie 48. Jackie, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
All right, we now turn to you, our listeners. For the last several weeks, we've been asking you to tell us how you're holding up, given everything that's going on. Take Two listener Joy called in earlier this week after a pretty shaky start to the year. Let's listen.
My name is Joy. I'm calling from Long Beach. And we've been feeling pretty stuck here, not just physically, but also mentally. And, you know, we've been hunkering down since March, and it's becoming a routine, but given the events that occurred last week, it's been really tough to move on and look away from the news. Unfortunately, my entire family has contracted COVID-19, and luckily they're recovering, but it's still really stressful on top of what's happening on a national level as well as a local level. But some of the hope that I'm still holding on to is the fact that Georgia Senate had flipped blue, and also here locally in Long Beach, there's some more women of color representing us in city council, so I'm looking forward to that.
That was Take Two listener Joy. If you want to share how you're doing, give us a call. Our number is 626-583-5281. That's 626-583-5281. Leave your name, where you're from, and how we can reach you, and we'll try to get your voice on the radio. More Take Two coming up. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. As we look to the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday this week, and many are reflecting on the state of racial equality and justice in our country, one film coming to Amazon today addresses those themes through the lens of events that happened 56 years ago. In 1964, four African-American icons met in a Florida hotel where black patrons were allowed to stay back then. Muhammad Ali, then known by his birth name Cassius Clay, had just won the heavyweight title. There was also singer Sam Cooke, NFL player Jim Brown, and a Muslim minister named Malcolm X. The film is One Night in Miami. Here's some of that trailer.
After the fight, we're all coming back here for the champs of victory, Porter. Don't be late.
Minister Malcolm X.
Good news, the chariot is coming.
You know I'm the greatest. That's right.
Jim Brown takes the ball.
Your record is going to stand the test of time.
How's everybody feeling tonight?
All together, yeah.
Oscar-winning actress Regina King makes her directorial debut with One Night in Miami, and it's written by Kemp Powers, who adapted it from his own play. Powers is also the co-writer and co-director of the latest Pixar film, Soul. Kemp, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
Wow, take us back to that night in 1964, because I don't know if many people know that these four men got together the way they got together. So why did they get together in the first place?
Well, they were friends. I mean, ostensibly, three of them were there to support their friend Cassius Clay, who they thought was going to upset Sonny Liston. I first discovered this, it was over 15 years ago. I was reading this great book about the intersection between pro sports and the civil rights movement that focused on Muhammad Ali. And there was one paragraph that just mentioned that that's February 25th, 64, when Cassius Clay beat Sonny Liston. No one thought he was going to win, of course, but he did.
I'm the greatest thing that ever lived. No. I don't have a mark on my face, and I upset Sonny Liston, and I just turned 22 years old. I must be the greatest. I told the world.
And he went back to his good friend, Malcolm X, who was a mentor of his at the time, to his hotel room, and he spent a quiet night in conversation over bowls of vanilla ice cream with Malcolm X, his other friend Sam Cooke, the singer, and Jim Brown, the football star. And the next morning is actually when he first announced to the press that he was a member of the Nation of Islam. And it was shortly after that that he would change his name and become the man we know as Muhammad Ali. So discovering that moment was just like dynamite going off in your brain. I mean, for men who represent so much to not just my generation, but several different generations, icons, and the idea of them not just being friends, but like being there on what was a crucible moment, not just for Cassius Clay, who was going to become Muhammad Ali, but for Jim Brown, who within a year would be retiring from the NFL abruptly while filming the Dirty Dozen and starting his acting career, and Sam Cooke, who had just recently recorded for the first time, A Change Is Gonna Come, and was going to be dead by within just a few months of this night. And of course, Malcolm X, who we all know was just weeks away from breaking away from the Nation of Islam, and all who would also be assassinated just a few days before the 1 year anniversary of this night. So it seemed like perfect grist for a drama.
At one point, Malcolm X looks at the other three, boxing champion, football great, musical star, and says, "You all could move mountains without even lifting a finger." So what did he mean by that?
He meant that their influence didn't require, physical exertion, physical activity. Their influence so transcended that. I mean, this came on the heels of him recounting a story about how Sam Cooke just using his voice, the voice being both a literal and a metaphorical thing, was able to move an entire crowd at a concert, even though there was no sound. What I love about the scenario is that it's not difficult to make the stretch and say, if you look at who Muhammad Ali would become, it's very easy to see him as an amalgamation of all three of those men, of Malcolm X's politics, of Jim Brown's physical prowess and athletic ability, and of Sam Cooke's swagger. So, and the reality of that night was that Cassius Clay was 22 years old. So he was the baby. So I very much wanted to structure this as like the kid brother who's about to make one of the most important decisions of his life, and his three big brothers kind of fighting a bit, so to speak, over the destiny of their kid brother.
Look, Alexander the Great conquered the whole world at the age of 30, and yeah. I conquered the world of boxing at 22 without sustaining so much as a scratch.
That's right. Oh,
there he goes.
You do the math.
All right. When is this party going down?
Yeah, that's a good question. What's on the agenda, Malcolm?
Well, I thought this would be a wonderful chance for us to reflect on what's happened tonight. Like our young brother said, there's no denying that greater forces were at work.
You mean no one else is coming?
Well, rest assured, my brother, you're not missing anything.
You know, the power of people in sports and pop culture, I mean, the power just seems to have grown over the years. I'll never forget, Kemp, a very famous picture. It's called the Cleveland Summit, and it had Jim Brown, Muhammad Ali, Bill Russell, one of the greatest basketball players of all time for the Boston Celtics, and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar sitting at a table with microphones talking about a lot of the same things that athletes talk about today. How do you see black athletes and artists using their voices now? Because it seems like a lot of the seeds of that were sown years and years ago.
Yeah, and it seemed like there was a period of time when athletes, maybe because of the promotional endorsements and stuff, got a lot quieter and didn't use their voices and didn't realize the power that they had for a number of years. And it's actually encouraging that seems to have changed in a dramatic way. I mean, you mentioned that summit, which is now known as the Ali Summit, which was actually organized by Jim Brown, by the way. And he'd held it at his Black Economic Union, which was something that people didn't know, is that the whole time that Jim Brown was in the Cleveland Browns, his Black Economic Union was devoted to giving business loans to Black-owned businesses. So he knew the power and influence he would have. But now you see athletes like LeBron James, who to me are like the second coming of that generation of athletes. So for a while, I think, you know, I know I wondered if, like, wow, are athletes ever going to realize again how much power and influence they can have, like the Jim Browns and the Muhammad Ali's of old? And it's actually encouraging to see a new generation of not just athletes, but musicians and performers and a lot of people who have so many ears being less afraid to use that platform.
Talking to writer and director Kemp Powers. Now, One Night in Miami ran as a play in the Rogue Machine Theater in L.A. It won a handful of L.A. Drama Critics Circle Awards. Then you took it to London, where it also played on stage. To me, it would have sounded right off the bat as something that would be perfect for the screen, but did you plan on adapting it for the screen?
No, not at all. Actually, I envisioned it as a play, and honestly, I didn't even think at all about adapting it into a film. At the time, I was just getting my career started as a playwright. And initially people did come to me very early on and inquire about optioning it, to which I said no for quite a while.
Really?
And yeah. And it was just coincidence that within a few years, my playwriting career had started morphing into a film and television writing career. So as I kind of developed a new set of skills as a screenwriter, I started thinking like, oh, now I could envision what I couldn't envision before, which is how I would tell this story as a film, which is actually quite different than how I would tell it as a play. And once I could see how I would do that, that's when I became, I think, a lot more open to the idea of adapting it.
Now, how did you get on the radar of Regina King?
Well, I had already written the script, the screenplay, and that's, you know, credit to our great producers who, you know, we knew that in adapting this, we were really excited about working with a director who, you know, this would be one of their first features under their belt. And so I think that was kind of like what they went out to the agencies with when they started their director search. And just through dumb luck that one of the first directors who did get her hands on it was Regina. Not only was she one of our first, she ended up being easily the best candidate, because while this is her first feature film, she'd had tons of experience directing television programs. In addition to that, we all know she's got more than 3 decades worth of experience as one of our finest actors. So if we were going to be successful in doing this story, it's so much driven by the conversations that these men are going to have in the room in these tiny small moments, I think we were lucky to have a director like her who's not only just gifted technically, but also has an incredible touch when it comes to working with individual actors as well.
You think about movies and TV, especially right now in 2020, 2021, they have a tremendous ability to really change the narratives of our history. What do you hope this film contributes to the collective understanding of Black history in America?
Wow, that's a big question, man. What do I think? Well, honestly, what I really hope that it contributes is that young people see and understand that the people that they deify, that they lionize, their heroes that they read about in their textbooks, were actually just young people just like them. They were human beings. They were young men who actually didn't know what they were doing, were scared, experienced doubt, experienced all the emotions that are naturally the emotions that a human being would feel, and they did it anyway. Because all these great movements, all this great change is always going to be brought about by young people. And I think that by turning them into gods, turning them into these icons, it actually makes them seem further away. And I hope this film helps young people see themselves as closer to these icons and capable of bringing about as much change as each of these four men were able to bring about in their lifetimes.
Ken Powers is the writer and an executive producer of the new Amazon movie One Night in Miami. He's also the co-writer and a co-director of the Pixar movie Soul. It's on Disney Plus. Ken, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since.
And this is Leslie Odom Jr., who plays Sam Cooke in One Night in Miami, singing Change Is Gonna Come from the soundtrack for the film.
Change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard. But I'm afraid to die.
Sorry to interrupt. More Take Two coming right up.
What's up there beyond the sky? It's been a long, long time coming, but I know.
Back now with More Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm Ian Martinez. The FBI has reportedly warned all 50 states that they could face armed protests starting tomorrow by supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump. If there is a demonstration in Sacramento, one self-styled citizen journalist from Los Angeles will be there to document whatever happens. He's one of a number of leftist videographers inspired by the George Floyd protests. KPCC's Frank Stoltz reports.
A couple of hours before Trump supporters stormed the Capitol last week, several hundred people gathered on the steps of L.A. City Hall for their own Stop the Steal rally.
The first thing that has to happen is take off the mask.
One guy stood out. He kept his mask on. He roamed the crowd with his iPhone, shooting video. He was 27-year-old Vishal Singh. People were suspicious.
We see you. We know who you are.
Okay.
Singh's video shows a half dozen men moving towards him. He's not a big guy. He only stands 5'6 and weighs just 100 pounds. Singh starts to back away. A few moments later, a friend of his pulls up his car. Singh hops in and they drive away.
So I'm a volunteer citizen / activist journalist.
Like a lot of people, Singh says he was radicalized by the killing of George Floyd and by what he saw as the LAPD's heavy-handed response to a massive protest on May 30th in the Fairfax District.
I had pretty much decided on that day, like, I'm going to come at least to 2 to 4 protests a week.
Singh says he had always been politically aware. His parents were part of an ethnic Indian minority that fled Fiji in the 1980s. He hung out with punk rockers growing up in the Silicon Valley. Singh works for Netflix, editing documentaries.
I think it's my opportunity and responsibility to use my skills to show a really honest, embedded perspective of what these protests are like from the protesters' perspective.
He's been arrested once and had his foot run over by someone trying to drive past a protest. That put him on crutches for a few weeks. The activist part of his role sometimes has him being an advocate for protesters, like the time earlier this month when he confronted a cop who had detained a woman outside LAPD headquarters.
Excuse me, what did she do, officer? Excuse me, what did she do exactly?
I'm asking a question.
Singh typically edits down what he shoots and posts the videos on social media. Occasionally, he adds narration, like for the video he shot one night last August when he was in the 2nd Street Tunnel in downtown L.A. with a group of protesters.
The moment we entered the tunnel, police surrounded us on both ends and trapped us in a claustrophobic space like sardines in a can.
The video shows officers firing projectiles. Singh says one hit him in the leg. Fast forward to a few days later.
I was playing video games, just trying to, like, relax. And then the sound effects in the video games, like, just gunshots in the video games actually just triggered me. And, like, I started screaming. I tore off my headphones. I, like, ducked under my bed. And at that moment, I was like, okay, this is something pretty severe.
But that didn't stop him from doing what's become his passion. Singh's Instagram following has grown from a few hundred to near 10,000. One video he helped edit of LAPD officers appearing to push a black man out of his wheelchair received a 250,000 views. Even some police know him, as you see on this video from a protest.
David Shaw, and I've seen your video.
Oh yeah, you guys are fans?
Singh's notoriety has seriously disrupted his personal life. He got a call one day last September from his older brother, who lived at the time with his parents.
And he told me that he, my mother, and my father all simultaneously received text messages from an unknown phone number.
The text included their address. It said, "I want to let you know Vishal has been involved in the riots and mayhem in Los Angeles. We will honor you with the same courtesy." His family put in a security system at their home and filed a police report. Singh stopped going to protests for nearly a month and considered stopping altogether, but decided against it.
In a way, that kind of motivated me more.
He did decide to move from one part of LA to another. Covering criminal justice, I'm Frank Stoltz.
All right, finally, if you need a break from it all, I mean, it is a 3-day weekend, we have some ideas for events you can look forward to.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran, and A. Martinez. I've been sharing some things to do over the weekends during quarantine for almost a year now. Yeah, crazy to think about.
Yep.
But it's going to keep going because of where we're at. But don't worry, people of LA are still coming up with creative ways to take a mental break from the world every weekend.
All right, I need that, Leo, so what's up first? Yeah.
Well, next Monday is Martin Luther King Jr. Day, which kind of feels like it's even more important in our lives in this current environment. But for people who actually don't know its history, he had a really rough time of trying to get his message across, partly because of the government. So today through Thursday, you can learn all about it through Cine Lounge in Hollywood. They're going to tell that story with a drive-in screening of the documentary MLK FBI. And that documentary details the government's history of targeting and harassing black activists during the civil rights era. Tickets are limited, so get them online now. And make sure your car radio is nice and booming so you can pick up the film's audio directly to your vehicle. Admission is by car, and that's $40.
All right, so that one feeds my brain. What if I want my funny bone tickled?
Well, then take a risk. I know we've all had to make tough choices in this past year, which sometimes seem risky, but you can actually take part in this stage storytelling show called Risk, which live streams tomorrow night. It's hosted by Kevin Allison, who's an alum of MTV's The State, and each storyteller shares a hilarious story about something risky they did, but, you know, something that's actually guaranteed to make you wistful for the days that risky things only led to social embarrassment. Think of stuff that you might have done in, like, middle school or high school. It's by Zoom, and to get your link, it's just $15 for a ticket.
All right, so finally, what's something to do for people who don't mind feeling like every day is the exact same one over and over and over again?
Well, dive into the classic where that idea was actually kind of funny to live through every day, like it just never stops, Groundhog Day, starring Bill Murray. Electric Dusk Drive-In is hosting a screening of this film Sunday night in the parking lot of the Glendale Sears, and tickets start at $23. Now, there are still a bunch more events to go to, whether you're online, in your car. Either way, it's going to be safe. Find out what you can do this weekend by heading to our site, laist.com. That's laist.com. And you can follow me on Twitter. That's at Leo Has a Cat.
That's KPCC's Leo Duran. Leo, thanks a lot.
Thanks, I.
You know, I just saw somewhere that Take Two is officially the best show to work out to. Just go to wherever you get your podcast, download the whole show, work out for 49 to 50 minutes, and you'll not only be more informed, but you'll also be in great shape. There you go. Take it from A. Martinez, your pal. Take Two is back Tuesday at 2. Talk to you then.
Support comes from Ciclavia, catalyzing vibrant public spaces, active transportation, and good health through car-free streets. Ciclavia promotes respect and infrastructure for bike and pedestrian-friendly public spaces. Enjoy these pop-up parks for the day in your favorite people-powered way. Jogging, biking, skating, strolling, or simply spectating. Free and open to all, Ciclavia Sundays generate miles of smiles in neighborhoods all over L.A. Details at www.ciclavia.org.